Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit DartmouthHitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And from Granite State College, offering diverse bachelor's and graduate business degree programs online. Designed to help working adults advance, Granite State College, where quality matters. More information and registration at granite.edu.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire has 221 towns, 13 cities, 1.3 million residents, and countless stories to tell. But while many of these tales are what you'd expect from a small, community-based state where one person really can make a difference, don't be fooled. Small-town politics can be just as rough as in the big city, and new ways aren't always greeted kindly. Here at NHPR, our reporters have a sharp eye out for these stories, the lovely slices of life and the not-so-lovely, the local news that doesn't often make headlines, but that keenly illustrates New Hampshire community life. Today in The Exchange, a special broadcast featuring some of our favorites, and our guide for the hour is NHPR's Todd Bookman. And Todd, thanks for helping us out.
Hi, Laura.
Well, this hour, we're going to hear all kinds of different stories from all over the state. But put together, Todd, what do these stories represent?
Well, collectively, I think they represent, you know, what happens when we humans interact. And by that, I mean, sometimes it goes well and sometimes it doesn't. Speaking broadly, you know, large cities, they are constantly in flux. Change is a part of urban life. There's like a constant resettling and remixing. You hear urban planners talk about life in a city like life in an ocean. But small towns are more like ponds. You know, main streets don't quite ebb and flow so much. The demographic makeup, the look and feel of the community is usually much slower to change. That change does happen, though. And when it does, it, you know, brings up all types of issues. And some of them are good and some of them are bad. And with these stories, the goal wasn't necessarily to try to capture each town's identity or changing identity. Instead, the aim is to kind of, you know, transport the listener to these places, places that we don't hear about all that often, and try to get a feel for some of those changes and some of the people and the characters in the town, you know, that all the residents there may already be talking about.
Well, let's go to the first story, Todd. It's one you reported on in March about a greenhouse in Loudoun, New Hampshire. That's a small town outside of Concord that also happens to be home to a major racetrack. So just set this greenhouse story up for us, Todd, please.
So just down the road, actually, on Route 106 from that racetrack, there's this new business, this giant glass greenhouse. And of course, you know, sometimes neighbors don't like the idea of a nuclear power plant or an oil pipeline or a prison moving into their community. You wouldn't expect to find much opposition to a greenhouse, though, but that's not what happened with Leaf Farms.
Let's hear the story.
The weather inside Leaf Farms makes you want to roll out a beach towel. It's 75 degrees, August-level humidity, with fans pushing a soft breeze. Operations manager Bob Ledoux points to the beneficiaries of this artificial climate.
That's Mizuna and Cress.
Baby greens.
Baby greens.
Built on the site of an old gravel pit, Leaf Farms invested $10 million to grow gourmet lettuce indoors in New Hampshire year-round. Henry Huntington, the CEO, says, hey, why not? The demand is there.
It was a big investment, but we saw that the market was great for this kind of product. You know, folks are looking for locally grown, you know, they want to know where their food is coming from and how it's grown.
And how it's grown at Leaf Farms is actually pretty spectacular. Robotic arms and conveyor belts shuffle the seedlings around the greenhouse. Sensors closely track growing conditions. Nutrients are delivered in precise doses. This place honestly feels less like a farm and more like a surgical suite. Not every element is under human control, however.
So the sun just broke through.
Yes.
You must like that.
We love sun. So we expect with our location, latitude and longitude, and this part of the country, we should be able to get about 80% of our light requirements from the sun.
And the other 20%? That comes from overhead lights, serious high-powered grow lights. Lights that, because of shorter winter days, Lee Farms has been running after the sun goes down. And when you turn on lights in a room made of glass, well...
I was pissed when I saw that light. I couldn't believe it. And I saw it, and I thought, now how can you do that?
Tom Schneider lives 6 miles as the crow flies from Lee Farms. His house is up on a ridge, and during the day, it is sweeping 360-degree sight lines. At night, it used to be nothing but stars. Until this very orange, very unnatural glow started penetrating the sky. His first thought?
What's this going to do to the view? And I think maybe that sounds kind of selfish. I should be more concerned with the ecological and the physiological and psychological impacts this might have. But initially I thought aesthetics.
Lee Farms does have a shade curtain installed at the greenhouse, but it's porous, more porous than they thought it would be. To try to appease their neighbors, they now turn the lights off during the evening and then back on again after midnight. But that concession isn't enough for some folks.
Okay, we'll start off. There's a lot of people here tonight. I'm assuming it's to discuss the leaf greenhouses. We'll go right to that discussion.
At the January meeting of the Loudoun Planning Board, people fired up about Lee Farms aired their frustrations. They asked why had permits been issued without an environmental impact study? Why weren't neighboring towns, including Canterbury, informed of the project?
And what's this going to do to our property values for the realtors? Who's going to want to buy a house in Loudoun when the sun is out at midnight?
It's worth pointing out here that this isn't the first light pollution complaint involving Henry Huntington, the owner of Lee Farms. He and his family run other greenhouses in Loudoun, very successful greenhouses, and there have been legal challenges over the lights at those locations. Another thing worth mentioning is that Huntington himself happens to be on the Loudoun Planning Board. He recused himself during this portion of the meeting and addressed those in attendance.
And as I've said before, we're going to fix it because I don't like it myself. We're going to fix this issue. But at this point, we don't have the resources or the time to be able to fix it right away.
Huntington has plans to add another greenhouse in 2019. And when he gets that building in place, he says he can halt operations at Lee Farms and install thicker shade curtains. Until then, manager Bob Ledoux plans to continue turning on the lights.
You know, I'm the guy that has to turn them on and drive home and see them in the rearview mirror and know that people are upset with me. It's not a great feeling.
All this remorse and controversy over some baby greens. Neighbors I spoke with told me they do support the concept of locally grown food. And even Tom Schneider, the guy 6 miles from Leaf, he's on board with sustainable agriculture in his community.
I can think of many other businesses that I would not want to see there. You know, so I am very grateful that we've got a greenhouse. I think somebody dropped the ball.
Henry Huntington, the CEO of Lee Farms, he joked that if he sells more greens, he can expand sooner and get those new shade curtains in place faster. Tom Schneider joked to me that if nobody buys the greens, those lights would probably get shut down pretty quickly too.
So Todd, you first reported that story in March. That was a while ago. What's the status of that greenhouse now?
Well, they say sunlight is the best disinfectant, right? Well, the longer days of summer, more natural light means that Lee Farms doesn't need to use their grow lights right now. That will change again, you know, this fall and into the winter, though. The Earth will continue on its orbit. The days will get shorter and those lights will probably get turned back on.
All right. Well, you have to go back out there and see what happens. So the next story comes from Peterborough. And unlike the Loudoun story that we just heard, where the community was divided, this is a real coming together story about a repair cafe where old junk gets new life. Let's hear.
Jeff Powell is trying to fix a floor lamp that's gone limp. The threads are worn and it won't stand up straight anymore. He figures a few carefully placed screws should solve the problem.
The challenge, of course, is to not drill through the wire. That would be bad. Step number one, unplug the lamp. Yes, safety first.
Powell is a volunteer at the Repair Cafe in Peterborough. It's a monthly event held inside a makerspace, kind of like a gym, but with tools and machinery. The concept is simple. If you've got a broken thing, bring it in, and folks like Powell will try to get it working again. That's how Anita Mendez ended up here with her sad, crooked lamp.
So you don't consider yourself handy?
I was trained to be a social worker. I can only talk.
In about half an hour, Powell has the lamp back in good working order. He's saving Anita Mendez a little money and, in his eyes, doing what's only natural.
I grew up in Pennsylvania, but I've always had a very strong Yankee streak, right? Reduce, reuse, recycle, blah, 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 the whole thing. But to me, it was just normal, right? You didn't throw things away. You fixed things. The concept of a disposable society was just a horror.
The Repair Cafe is equal parts an environmental movement and an economic one. The first cafe took place in 2009 in Amsterdam. Martina Postma was a journalist writing about sustainability issues when she came up with the idea, a place where people could get together and mend their broken stuff and have a decent time.
Well, it makes you feel good to get something working again instead of just replacing it.
That good feeling has taken off. There are now more than 1,200 repair cafes being held around the globe. Each one is free, open to everyone, and even the unskilled among us are encouraged to lend a hand. Or at the very least, strike up a conversation while you watch.
So, and this is what the Repair Cafe does. It brings together people who elsewhere might not have met, might never have talked to each other. Well, that connects people.
There are different workbenches set up around the room. A table for jewelry repairs, one for small appliances and electronics, a bicycle station. Chase Wilson Roper is sifting through a collection of broken earrings and necklaces. Some are family heirlooms. Others just items she doesn't want to see end up in a landfill.
I know that things can be made to last for decades. And they're just not, because it's not good for the economy, they think.
Today, though, even simple items are packed with technology. Jeff Powell says it requires a fair bit of confidence to take on that kind of project.
As you know, it used to be a toaster had a plug and a heating element and a switch, and that was it. And now the guy came in with a toaster. It's got a computer inside of it. It's a computerized toaster, for Pete's sake. But the guy who's usually here, he fixed it. It was pretty amazing, actually.
A broken toaster, now making toast again.
And this is The Exchange on NHPR. Today in The Exchange, it's a special broadcast highlighting stories of small-town life in New Hampshire. I'm Laura Kanoy. NHPR's Todd Bookman is with us. And Todd, let's go from Peterborough to a little further south to Ringe, New Hampshire. And here you present one of those wow, who knew stories about a multi-million-dollar art forgery. Lots of characters involved in sort of a bizarre story. Todd, who are the key players to listen for?
Sure. So there are really three main characters in this one. A terrific New York-based contemporary artist. His name is Leon Golub. There's a Wall Street millionaire, somebody who likes to buy a lot of art. And then there's this mother-son couple from Ringe who really become the middleman in some of these art transactions.
All right, let's hear this story again from January of this year.
The paintings of Leon Golub aren't all that easy to look at. His works, some small, others massive wall-sized canvases, deal with violence and power. There are roughly sketched images of prisoners being tortured, of police brutality and dictators. Golub, who died in 2004, may not be a household name, but his works hang in the Museum of Modern Art, the Art Institute of Chicago, and the Whitney Museum.
I once described myself as a machine for producing monsters.
This is Golub speaking about his art in a documentary.
And I keep producing them, but my production of monsters is really minuscule compared to the real production of monsters.
British-born Andrew Hall is a fan of Leon Golub. He's also well-known on Wall Street as an oil trader. He once garnered a $100 million bonus. Here he is speaking to a Florida PBS station about one of his passions, art collecting.
And whoever you are, you are operating essentially within a budget. And that budget, I think, can go much further when you seek out overlooked corners of the art world.
In the early 2000s, Hall began buying dozens of Leon Golub paintings and drawings. According to court documents, that includes 24 pieces sold to him by a Ringe, New Hampshire family, Loretan Gascard and her son Nicholas. Loretan was an art history professor at Franklin Pierce University, and she ran an on-campus gallery. In 2015, as Hall and staff members at his foundation began to prepare a major exhibit of Golub paintings at his own gallery, the authenticity of some works were called into question. The estate of Leon Golub maintains an extensive inventory of nearly everything he painted, but there were no records of the 24 artworks obtained through the Gascards. Court documents detail how a longtime studio assistant of Golub said these works had, quote, unusual formal characteristics. That is, they just didn't look right. They concluded that these two dozen paintings, much to Andrew Hall's dismay, were clever forgeries. He filed a $700,000 lawsuit against the Gascards last September.
So here in Keene, a quiet residential street, this is the apartment where the Gascards live, but they don't seem to be here. They haven't been speaking with the press anyways.
For months, the Gascard family seemed to have vanished. They left their apartment in Ringe, didn't file a response to the allegations in court. Even a private investigator hired by Hall couldn't find them. But just last week, the Gascards resurfaced, providing the courts with an address for this apartment in Keene. They did also email New Hampshire Public Radio, again declining to comment, except to say that they will, quote, address the false allegations vigorously. We do know that Loretan claimed she was a student of Leon Golub's in the late 1960s and maintained a friendship with him until his death. However, Leon Golub's family disputes that and say they never heard him mention Loretan. According to an online biography, Gascard is 68 years old. She was born in New York City, earned a PhD in Germany, and lived and worked in Bangladesh, Austria, and several African countries. In the late 1990s, she landed in Ringe to teach at Franklin Pierce. Neighbors say she was friendly, intelligent, but also secretive. Former students I spoke with described her as a striking figure on campus, often dressed in all black. Like any professor, she had her fans and her detractors.
I did learn a lot about art history. I think she knows her stuff. But as far as like person to person, she was not an easy person to be around by any means.
Catherine Michaud graduated from Franklin Pierce in 2009 and took Gascard's class her freshman year.
I think of her whenever I go to a museum because she did teach me how to read paintings. She was like, I learned from her, but it was like her as a person was just like very peculiar and off and cold, just very cold.
Gascard left Franklin Pierce in 2015 after settling an age discrimination suit. Those court documents describe a contentious work environment, with accusations of bullying and theft of school property by a colleague. Now, Loretan finds herself back in the legal system, forced to explain how exactly she came to possess 24 allegedly forged paintings of someone she describes as an old friend, Leon Golub.
And this is The Exchange on NHPR. Today, stories of small-town New Hampshire life, tales from around the state that highlight what it means to live in community here. NHPR's Todd Bookman is with us. And Todd, what is this last story about this bizarre art forgery and court case and so on? What does this illustrate for you?
You know, I think it riffs on the theme that you don't really always know who your neighbors are and what they're up to. And we'll actually have another story later this hour from Sean Hurley on just that. It's funny, I knocked on a bunch of neighbors' doors for that story, and nearly everybody I spoke with, they said some version of the same thing, that they actually weren't totally surprised by these allegations. You know, of course, it's easy to say something like that after the news has broken, but, you know, yeah, we all have our own secrets, and it's certainly, you know, New Hampshire, New England culture not to be too nosy. You know, good fences make good neighbors. So I think it's just that idea that we don't always know who's living next to us and what they're up to.
Sure, and you're right. It's sort of a cultural value of, you know, live and let live, live free or die, and then all of a sudden it turns out your neighbor is involved in this type of a case.
Allegedly,
so, yeah. Allegedly. All right. Well, coming up, we'll be back with more of our special broadcast in just a moment, including an involved tale of political upheaval in a tiny North Country town. All that's coming up, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
my name is Arielle. I'm calling from Derry.
My name is Elise. I'm from Alaska.
My name is Ina, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
From the Alaskan wilderness to the streets of New York City, NHPR Civics 101 is your guide to how American democracy works.
I had a question about term limits.
How does the Electoral College work?
Can you help me explain the National Security Council to my students?
Subscribe to the podcast and submit your questions at civics101podcast.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's a special broadcast on small town life in New Hampshire. We're featuring some of our favorite stories about communities coming together and coming apart. We're drilling down into the local news that may not make headlines, but tells us a lot about Granite State life. Our guest for the hour is NHPR's Todd Bookman. He's the reporter and producer for many of these pieces. And Todd, this next one is fascinating. It's about small town politics in Lisbon and a populist revolt. Let's hear.
Lisbon, New Hampshire is nestled between the Vermont border and the White Mountain National Forest. The Ammonoosuc River winds through, splitting the town. Around lunchtime, Gene Becker sets up a popular hot dog cart in a vacant lot just east of that river.
Well, we figured with the factories in town and people driving through, tourists and all, and nice little hot dog cart here.
And how's business so far?
Starting out slow. Weather hasn't been real agreeable, but it's coming.
And so you live in the neighboring town, but you've heard a little bit about what's been happening in the town government here in Lisbon?
Yes. Yeah, we were happy to get our permit before it all broke loose.
It is a town that needs something good to happen to it.
Ina Lippard and her husband Ron have lived in Lisbon since the mid-1980s. For a while, they ran a small jewelry and gem shop in town.
When we moved here, we had a lovely bakery. We had a functioning drugstore. It was a nice little town that worked on its own, and people got along. You could walk down Main Street and nobody was yelling at you. And it's declined a lot.
Even Lisbon's biggest cheerleaders would admit the town isn't thriving. There's still a large wire manufacturing plant, but many other blue-collar jobs in the region have disappeared. The population, around 1,500, hasn't grown since the 1970s. Property values have stagnated. This is the Lisbon that Thomas Demers wanted to fix as a selectman. After serving on the town's budget advisory committee at just 24 years old, he ran for select board at 25. Not to be a politician, but to be a public servant.
I always feel that it's important for people, regardless of age, they should serve their town at some sort of capacity.
But after winning office, Tommy came to see the big picture items would have to wait. Lisbon had more immediate matters, including its bookkeeping, which was a mess.
We were literally keeping our head above water at that point. We were maintaining, but just barely.
There was also no town administrator. This is a big job in small towns. He or she will oversee major purchases and bids, writes grants, deals with timber tax billings, land use penalties, the nitty-gritty stuff that keeps a town going. The board posted the town administrator job, and in August of 2015, they hired a guy named Dan Murhalski, who had previously held government jobs in Michigan, Maine, and Massachusetts.
It was night and day being a selectman this time while Dan was there versus last time when it felt a little more like we were just kind of flying by the seat of our pants.
This is Peter Nightingale, who was elected in March of 2016, about 8 months after Dan Murhalski was hired. This was Nightingale's second time being a Lisbon selectman, and he says Dan was organized and professional. Tommy Demers described Dan as like having Superman on staff. But, and here's where our troubles begin, Dan wasn't exactly welcomed by the town.
I had the hair on the back of my neck stand up.
Ina Lippard is a trustee for the Lisbon cemeteries. She and her husband pay attention to town business, at least certainly more so than most of us would. Ron Lippard also did not take to Dan Murhalski.
He always wore black. And one night I asked him, you know, you really don't come off as a genuine person who's interested in other people by looking like a funeral director. And he didn't smile, he didn't laugh, and he didn't change his attire.
A few months into Dan's tenure as town administrator, tensions between him and some town employees began to bubble up. Dan had implemented new personnel and spending policies that weren't going over well. Staff described him as aggressive and rude, not so much a boss, but a bully. And many of these employees had deep roots in Lisbon. They were known around town. Dan Murkowski was an outsider.
We have somebody running the town that's making decisions that doesn't even live in this town, that doesn't see the impact it's causing in this town, and we're concerned that he doesn't even care.
This is sound from a Board of Selectmen meeting. In the spring of 2016, residents started showing up to complain, warning that Dan Murkowski was running rampant. I reached out to Dan about this. In an email, he says he was simply carrying out the directives of Lisbon's elected officials, and that he acted with integrity at all times. During these select board meetings, though, Peter Nightingale says Dan was often just trying to defend himself.
There's an older lady in town who, at many, many meetings, was the one that would personally attack Dan. And then when Dan responded, it was like, oh my God, he's so mean. He's being mean to an 80-year-old lady. Well, the 80-year-old lady could be pretty nasty herself.
Nightingale says one issue that kept popping up during board meetings is emblematic of just how low relations between the town and its government were beginning to sink.
The dump truck thing, as stupid as it is, the dump truck thing made me mad.
The dump truck thing. It started out as an accounting mistake. No money had gone missing, but $106,000 put aside for the purchase of a new town dump truck had somehow been put into the wrong account. While the board explained this situation at numerous meetings, some residents just wouldn't let it go.
There's still people on Facebook saying that, you know, oh, this person stole it, or this person stole it, or better get in some forensic accountant because this, you know, they're taking money. And, you know, it's just ridiculous that this one click in this case, you know, just was trying to push this out there.
In the summer of 2016, less than a year into Dan Murkowski's tenure as town administrator, that click, or if you'd prefer, group of concerned residents, they began to organize. They posted a petition in the gas station near the hot dog cart. It called for the removal of Dan Murkowski.
And we hereby request his dismissal from his current position be initiated as soon as possible. We further request...
On July 11th of last year, the Board of Selectmen presided over a public meeting that quickly turns into a trial. After reading the petition, there's back and forth about employee grievances and whether or not Dan planned to close the town dump. And then...
Did you have this much trouble with the last job you got fired from?
A male voice asks, did you have this much trouble in the last job you got fired from?
I didn't get fired from my last job, so get your facts straight.
Dan's last job is worth mentioning. He was town administrator for Denmark, Maine, a small community about a dozen miles from the New Hampshire border. His tenure in Denmark ended as a result of tension with some town employees and residents who, like they would eventually do here in Lisbon, organized and launched a petition.
Yes, it is. This is about you having a problem with me personally and going to the place I used to work at and following their game plan, even using the exact same language they used in their petition, which also...
The reason why we use the same petition is your behavior has been repeated.
After about an hour, the meeting was adjourned. In the coming days, the board released a public statement. They would not be firing Dan Murkowski. For Ina Lepard, this was an example, the latest example, of Lisbon's elected officials ignoring the will of the people, of taxpayers not having control and not getting their money's worth.
If you're paying some of the highest taxes in the state and you're seeing some of the worst roads and you're buying bottled water because your water is no good, you're going to be upset. I'm paying all this money. It gets to people.
There's this narrative in Lisbon that I heard from multiple people that the tax rate in town is extraordinarily high, but the services don't measure up. You'll hear some version of this, of course, everywhere, but it's closer to home in a place like Lisbon, a place where the economy is a shell of what it once was. It creates a mistrust of government and tension. And in Lisbon, that tension landed squarely on Dan Murkowski. By winter, a second petition began circulating, calling for his role as town administrator to be put up for a townwide vote. Rather than face that, on February 9th of this year, Dan Murkowski resigned. In an email to NHPR, he writes, "Despite my honest efforts to work for the good of the town, the rumor mill and petty personal desires eroded any goodwill." He continues, quote, "I wish the good residents of Lisbon all the best." The timing of Dan's resignation was particularly bad for selectman Tommy Demers.
There's a cause and effect. We get rid of Dan. Okay, so what happens? Who's going to do the work? The board, we've already said we can't do the work, and Dan was already swamped as it was. So what do we do?
It was just a month before town meeting, an event that requires documents and budgets be assembled for public review. Demers, Nightingale, and the third member of the board, Matt Uramian, they scrambled to get everything in order. They took time off from their paying jobs. But it was clear they wouldn't be ready. The night before town meeting, March 20th, there was a meeting of the Board of Selectmen. Ina Lippard kept notes.
The evening started out normally. They were 1 minute late starting the meeting. It was 5:46. They reviewed bills and contracts and papers, the normal things the selectmen do at the beginning of a meeting.
Then it gets brought up that the board won't have all the necessary paperwork for the next day. But there was one document that had already been distributed. It was the Board of Selectmen's report, a simple one-page statement written by the board members. In most years, it's pretty boring. This one wasn't.
The Board of Selectmen wants to first inform you that we have overcome extreme hurdles in 2016, stemming from the rotating town government, town staff, and overall townspeople.
The letter goes on to ask the public to stand behind their town and participate, the implication being the townspeople, you know, weren't.
It was, aside from preachy, it was weird.
This is Deb DeSantos, a Lisbon resident and vocal critic of the board.
It just didn't look like any selectman's report I'd ever... It's the selectman's report. This, you know, it was fault-finding, it was weird, it was just...
So why write it? Peter Nightingale says the selectmen, they wanted to send a message.
And I think the general thought was that we're just sick of people bitching without stepping up to do something.
I mean, it's understandable why that letter didn't go over well with some people.
Absolutely. Yeah, and would I do it the same way? Probably.
That night, Deb DeSantos and others let their displeasure with the letter be known.
Now you need to start getting some respect toward the people.
That was it. Suddenly, Peter, fed up with hearing complaints, fed up with a year of criticism and rumors, he stands up and quits. Matt Uramian does the same. And then board chair Tommy Demers, he also quits, turns over his keys to town hall. Here's Tommy.
Game over. You're not going to make these people happy. You can't implement change that's going to have a positive outcome. Your team is gone. You know, the legs have been cut out from underneath them. You're done. It's game over.
Demers, who at the age of 25 ran for the board, who serves his country in the National Guard, and who also wanted to serve his town, he gives up.
That's pretty much it in a nutshell.
The next day, newspapers and TV stations made the happenings in Lisbon a story. Town selectmen all resign. It was the type of story an already struggling community doesn't need.
I think it was a terrible embarrassment for the town of Lisbon for them to do that the way they did it.
But Deb DeSantos says the battle over Dan Murkowski, the confrontations with the board, it needed to happen. Someone needed to speak up.
The proof of the pudding's in the eating. Bills weren't being paid. Nobody knew where the money was going. And the product that we were getting from both the town administrator and the select board was chaos. It was chaos. That's the final word.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. If you're just joining us, it's a special broadcast today. Stories about community life in New Hampshire. NHPR's Todd Bookman is with us. And Todd, first, just give us the after story, please. How is Lisbon doing today after all those troubles?
Well, by all accounts, they're doing much better. I've been in touch with a few of the voices in the story, as well as the new board chair. And the business of the town is basically back on track. There are a few new select board members, some volunteers, some who are elected. The public meetings are running much more smoothly. It seems like the chaos, for now at least, has, you know, basically died down.
How familiar do you think, Todd, some of these themes are in small town politics?
You know, I think it's easy to just say that this was about personality conflicts or, you know, an outsider coming in and shaking things up in, you know, the form of Dan Murkowski in that story. And yes, I think that definitely helped escalate the tensions in Lisbon. But, you know, Lisbon is also going through this massive decades-long change, and it's a change that's taking place across many New Hampshire towns. Towns that used to rely on manufacturing and industry as their backbone, you know, every town that had a river and a mill, basically. And the economies are reinventing themselves, at, you know, in the best sense, hopefully, or stagnating. And this really puts pressure on residents because, you know, there's still a school to pay for and there are roads and upkeep on the bridges and there's police and there's fire. You know, taxes are certainly much more easy to swallow if you can see the positive result of that money. And as we heard in that story, in Lisbon, there are just people that feel like they aren't seeing the positives. And they blame the town's government for that. And in a lot of ways, I think it's a, you know, it's a situation that's mirrored or perhaps magnified, you know, when we think about the frustrations with the federal government.
Well, and at a time when research tells us that New Hampshire cities are sort of getting their groove and they're doing really well. But you're right. Some of these small old mill towns are still trying to figure out what's our economic base. What do we do? Young people are leaving.
Yeah. Some of these towns need to create a new identity for themselves. And you know, that change that we talk about, it can be hard. And some people can feel like they're being left behind.
I've also heard from lots of sort of public officials that they're worried about the younger generation, you know, who's going to take these positions of public service when we step down. So here's some young folks in Lisbon trying to, you know, step up and participate. How much is there a young versus old dynamic in this piece, Todd?
You know, Tommy Demers, young kid, working hard as a landscaper in the National Guard, loves this town. He stepped up. He wanted to help. You know, he had his successes and he had his failures. I'm not sure age factored in as much to this story. We've actually got a story next segment that we'll take a listen to where there's a much clearer divide between young and old. I think here we just had a case of, you know, in some sense, insurmountable problems. And chaos was the result.
Well, there's an old-fashioned rumor mill element to this story, too, Todd, but spread by social media. They say in the story, you know, on Facebook they were saying this, even though it's not true. It reminds me of the national arguments that we're having over this right now, over false information being paraded as true on Facebook or Twitter or wherever.
Yeah, we heard Peter Nightingale in the story. He remarks on how the dump truck thing, this, you know, alleged scandal of whether or not he had siphoned off or somebody had siphoned off money for a new town dump truck. You know, it kept coming up on the town's unofficial Facebook page. You know, there was a lot of misinformation floating around Lisbon for months. And I don't think that that was intentional. I think it actually stemmed from a lack of communication between the government, the town employees, and the residents. But it definitely fuels mistrust and it fuels tension. And when you're constantly fighting to just arrive at an agreeable set of facts, it's hard to go beyond that and try to find solutions. And that also we're seeing with the rise of so-called fake news and everything we're seeing in Washington.
Well, coming up, more of our special broadcast on small town community life in the Granite State. We will hear about an odd city flag in Laconia, a world-class croquet court on the seacoast, and Sean Hurley's reflections on how we really don't know our neighbors at all. That's all coming up, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's a special broadcast on small-town life in New Hampshire. We're featuring some of our favorite stories about communities coming together and coming apart. Our guest for the hour is NHPR's Todd Bookman. He's the reporter and producer on many of these pieces. And Todd, the next one is about the city flag for Laconia. Now, I have to say, who knew Laconia even had a flag?
And that's really the issue that we'll hear, you know, comes up. If you have a flag, but nobody uses it, nobody actually flies it, you know, is it a flag? And perhaps should you create a new one?
All right. Well, let's hear this story about an effort to redesign Laconia's flag.
Inside room 200-A of Laconia City Hall, right above where the mayor sits during council meetings, there's a frame.
It's the city flag right there on the wall.
Bree Henderson has spent the past year thinking about this flag. The background of it is broken into four triangles. The top triangle is green, the lower triangle blue,
and either side in white.
In the middle, something that looks a lot like roadkill. It's the rough outline of nearby Lake Winnipesaukee, though it's been turned on its side.
The seal of the city over top of it, with the words Lake Winnipesaukee straddling the seal.
And then the words Laconia, New Hampshire spelled out at the bottom. Compared to the Stars and Stripes or Canada's elegant maple leaf, this is a busy flag.
Complex.
Do you think it's very good?
I think if it were better, it would be used more.
Bree Henderson wants a new flag for her adopted hometown. She's 28 years old, has short hair, owns an old-timey barbershop on Main Street. She got the idea for the project from a TED Talk given by Roman Mars, who also hosts a popular podcast on design called 99% Invisible.
But a great city flag is something that represents a city to its people and its people to the world at large. And when that flag is a beautiful thing, that connection is a beautiful thing.
Mars challenged people to take a hard look at their city flag and call out the ones that don't inspire any connection. He also laid out five simple rules for what makes a good city flag, rules that were borrowed from a book on the subject called Good Flag, Bad Flag. Ted Kaye is the author. Here's rule number one.
Keep it simple. A flag should be so simple that a child can draw it from memory.
Kaye's rule number two.
Use meaningful symbolism. The flag's images, its colors, and its patterns should relate to what it symbolizes.
Rule number three, use just a few basic colors. Flag rule number four, no words or seals because they can't easily be read from a distance. And number five, Kaye says be distinctive. A good flag captures the place, its people, and its history.
It also creates a central rallying point for civic pride. It helps link together people in the community saying, this is us, here we are under our flag.
Ted Kaye says ever since that Roman Mars TED Talk, cities across the country have redesigned and simplified their flags. That includes Manchester, which is planning a public redesign competition next year. Laconia also agreed to a competition. This summer, the city council even put up $1,000 in prize money to attract more applicants. And it worked. The city received more than 100 flag designs, many of which adhered to the good flag, bad flag ground rules. They're simpler, sharper than what the city has now. So the committee narrowed it down to six semifinalists, which were then presented this week to city council, which promptly shot the whole thing down.
Why are we changing it? What is so wrong with our present flag?
Brenda Baer represents Laconia Ward 4. She voted against selecting a new design.
There wasn't one submission that had anything or said anything about Laconia whatsoever. There was no relationship in any of them to the city.
Baer says she doesn't buy the idea that Laconia would somehow suddenly rally together under a new flag. Some irony here is that the old flag, the current flag, was designed through a competition. A high school kid in 1965 drew it up. The city adopted it and then forgot about it. Bree Henderson says she's not done fighting for a new one.
If I compared the city flag to a city employee who hadn't done their job in 50 years, don't you think it might be time to replace them?
That piece about a young person trying to make change in her city. Our next story in our special broadcast is about an older gentleman settling in, really creating community. This next one, Todd Bookman, isn't by you. It's by our colleague Jason Moon, our Seacoast reporter. What do you like about this story?
Well, I think it's a great example of, you know, one of those oddities that you come across in your town or a town you're visiting, something, you know, you drive past, it catches your eye, you don't know what it is, where it comes from, who created it, and why. And with this story, you know, Jason Moon just decided to stop by and learn a little bit more about this sort of hidden gem.
Stop the car, look out, see what it is. Let's go to it. This is Jason Moon's story on a hidden croquet court.
When you stand in the middle of Jim McLaughlin's croquet court in Rye and look out at Route 1A, you can actually watch the people in passing cars turn their heads as they try to figure out just what they're looking at. McLaughlin is used to this. Even before the court was finished some 17 years ago, he says his neighbors couldn't help but wonder.
People would ask me, you know, what's it gonna be? And it was one day, a little bit sarcastic, I guess, and I said, a helioport. That night, I got a call from the town fathers in Rye, and they called, it's come to our attention that you think you're building a helioport. They say, you can't build a helioport. You don't have permission, and if you ask for permission, you wouldn't get it anyway.
What McLaughlin was building in his backyard was a 6-wicket croquet court with perfectly level lime green turf designed to make croquet balls roll at a consistent speed. In the spring, a groundskeeper uses a heavy roller to level it. And in the fall, he keeps it clear of pine needles from nearby trees.
They come and yeah, I'll sure. be glad to answer.
But... And then you can explain.
When I arrive, McLaughlin is lounging in a lawn chair shaded by those trees. He's wearing white sneakers, white shorts, white polo, and a white cap, traditional croquet attire. He wears glasses and is quick to flash a warm smile. As I settle into a lawn chair next to his, he tells me his relationship with croquet actually began with his love for another sport, long-distance running.
I used to run about 50 races a year, you know, like 5Ks and 10Ks. And my wife, who died in 2010, was not a runner. And I'd go, she said, what are you doing today? I'm going to Methuen to run a race or something. And I'd be running, I felt guilty. And she would come with me if there was a good mall. You know, but if there wasn't a good mall, she was going to sit, you know, generally and watch it.
So about 15 years ago, McLaughlin and his wife searched for a sport they could enjoy together. After a few months of trying out croquet, they decided it was time to get serious and build their own court. And even though his wife, Myra, has died, McLaughlin is rarely alone. His backyard has become the official court for the Strawberry Bank Croquet Club, a magnet for professional players in the region. In fact, on the day I stopped by, some of those pros were setting up for a game.
See, what he's doing now is measuring court speed.
Carlton Mabee, a 3-time national champion in 6-wicket American croquet, gives me a few lessons before they start.
And yellow is the striker ball and black is the escape ball. So when you're peeling a ball through its appropriate hoop, you have to have an escape ball or your turn.
This is not the kind of croquet you played in the backyard growing up, maybe just whacking at balls with a mallet. 6-wicket croquet is a game of complex strategy where players are forced to think several moves ahead. It's often described as a mix of billiards and chess. This morning, Mabee is playing Bert Meyer, who is slated to be inducted into the Croquet Hall of Fame in West Palm Beach, Florida later this year. As their game gets underway, a hush falls over the court. There's only the occasional clink of the mallet hitting the ball and the sound of the ocean breeze filtering through the trees. McLaughlin and another player, Lloyd Haddon, try to give me a play-by-play of the strategies at work in the match. But despite their best efforts, I have no idea what's going on.
So he went out of bounds that time, right?
No.
No, he didn't.
The striker ball, if he hits a ball and goes out of bounds, it doesn't count.
Okay. This is not the striker ball. How long did it take you to feel like you really had a good grasp of it?
I still don't.
A couple years playing two or three times a week.
It's that sheer complexity of the game that keeps players like Haddon coming back here day after day.
It keeps Alzheimer's away.
And Haddon says despite how relaxed a croquet match can seem from the outside, beneath the surface, it's another story.
I used to race motorcycles, and the adrenaline rush in that was pretty impressive. Well, playing in a tournament against good people, you get the same, exact same rush.
At some point during the match, McLaughlin mentions that his home, which sits just a few feet away from the court, is where he was born and grew up. He moved out of state after college and ended up spending most of his working life in New York City. And he used to think that's where he would retire. But he says between the family history, the ocean breeze, and his croquet court.
Oh, this is better. This is better.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. It's a special broadcast today. Stories about community life in New Hampshire. NHPR's Todd Bookman is our guide. And Todd, we're going to go to our last story now. It's about Sean Hurley. It is about how Sean, although he's lived in his home for some time, really doesn't know his neighbors as well as he thinks. Let's hear.
Where we live, on a dead-end dirt road in the White Mountains, the house lights of our neighbors are mostly out with the sun. We have three sets of neighbors, older couples, their children grown and gone. It's mostly the men I see, in whose lives I know a bit, divided though we are by a river, by trees, by a great horse field. All through the summer, as early as possible, nearly every day, and no matter what, neighbor one mows his lawn. Retired now, with 5 acres to tend, one prefers to chip away at the grass, an hour or so a day. On Monday, he slaloms the pines beside the river on a sit-down mower. On Tuesday, he jets across the horse field in a full-size tractor. At 6 a.m., neighbor two heads off to work in a big-bellied pickup, his left elbow locked in the open window. Sunglasses before sunup, great mustache like a black sheep on a cliff. His headlights scan our curtains as he turns down the road. He tiptoes his truck by us as quietly as he can. You hear more the tires crushing gravel than the grumble of engine. At the end of the day, if he sees me, he'll nod down over the wing of his elbow, as though I am a boy, as though he is passing high above me in a plane. Neighbor three lives on the river as we do. Excavators, bulldozers, cherry pickers come and go on his land. He turns trees into neat cords of wood and streamlines the earth around his part of the river so it never floods. It took years for me to discover that he was also a race car driver, dirt tracks in the summer, ice ponds in the winter. Often the people you live closest to, you know the least. You take it slow with neighbors. While you've got all the time in the world, you don't have all the space. So you get to know them over the course of years and from a horizon of impressions. And the piecemeal story you put together about who they are is never right and never ends. Neighbor one, for example, stops mowing at 9 or 10. Exhausted, I suppose. He's reached his limit. I imagine him spent behind a checkered tablecloth, sipping lemonade, getting ready for tomorrow's rotten case of mildly tall grass. But then, I hear, he is a gardener, a green thumb, it is said. And on the far side of his yard, tipped from my view, he's brought up a stunning landscape. Rows of canoe paddle corn, huge red tomatoes inflate over polished curls of squash. The heart of his day is not lawn mowing, but a secret garden. There is no checkered tablecloth, no long lemonade ruminations. But this, I am learning, is what neighbors do best. Slowly, suddenly, they are someone else. The neighbor who lived in the house before neighbor one told me the moment he was leaving that his favorite thing in the world was hunting for a kind of extra wily goat on frozen mountains. Maybe, I reasoned, he meant the fast-hopping deer in the cold hills nearby. But in the very final moment we were neighbors, he dragged from his red barn the spectacular dragonfly of a helicopter, which is the thing about neighbors that's easy to forget. It doesn't happen often, but eventually there's a racing car, suddenly a secret garden. It could even be the very last moment when the helicopter comes flying out the red barn. But you can only go so long and be so blind to something so fantastic. So close, so far away. For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
We live up in New Hampshire, We don't have lawns, we have pastures. When we go outside, we use lanterns. It's pretty dark in New Hampshire. We went to the city, got blown away. Not a single pasture there anyway. So I came back here to New Hampshire. We don't have questions, just answers. We don't have cars, we drive tractors. All in New Hampshire. In New Hampshire, all here in New Hampshire.
Closing out our special broadcast on The Exchange with a song by Sean Hurley. That was great. Todd Bookman, so what's next for these types of stories that you and the rest of the news team have been working on about small town community life in New Hampshire?
Yeah, so we're going to collect all of these stories and continue to do more of them. We're putting them on a special site on our website, so it'll be easy to find, and you know, listeners can come and sort through them. We're calling this little event Locals, Stories from New Hampshire Towns and Communities, so you'll be able to see a link. We're going to continue to pursue these types of stories, and we're of course always interested in hearing from our listeners with their own ideas. They can chime in about interesting things taking place in their towns. We're also very interested in hidden histories, so stories about how your town came to be, or some interesting structure or, place in that community that really speaks to the community that the backstory may not be so well known to. So we're going to continue to report those out and have fun with them.
Well, if you need a theme song for this special series, you could maybe get Sean Hurley
compose
and sing it for
Absolutely.
You. Todd, just real quick, what areas of New Hampshire life would you especially like to explore more of?
Well, we're excited. The newsroom is going to take on this little project this summer where we're talking about islands in New Hampshire. So we're going to dig into some great island stories, not just seacoast islands in Lake Winnipesaukee or other islands scattered throughout the state, stories from islands, people who feel like they're on an island, that sort of thing. So that's sort of a next little project coming from the NHPR newsroom.
All right, great. Well, Todd, thank you so much. It's been absolutely wonderful working through these stories with you.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks for playing them.
That's NHPR's Todd Bookman. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Special thanks today to Michael Brindley, Corey Princell, Dan Barrick, Sarah Plourd, and Rebecca Lavoie. The engineer for this special broadcast was Dan Colgan, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.